and welcome to my podcast. I shouldn't say this, but my name is Katie Leeson, and it is my absolute pleasure to welcome the incredible Alex Holmes onto the podcast today. Alex is Deputy CEO at the Diana Award and advisor for the likes of TikTok, Twitch, Twitter, and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and is dedicated to addressing barriers to children's happiness and well-being. He is absolutely incredible. And not only does he do all those things, but through his work, he has been named one of the 100 people who make Britain a happier place to live by The Independent on Sunday, as well as receiving the Muhammad Ali Humanitarian Award. Just crazy credentials. I'm so pleased that he's agreed to come on this podcast this week. In the episode, we discuss the legacy this generation will leave, and hint, it is a positive one, the work social media platforms are putting in behind the scenes to combat trolling, and why it's not as simple as we all think it could be. And finally, why it's time to cancel culture. So sit back, relax, and enjoy this episode of I Shouldn't Say This But. So you're Deputy CEO at the Diana Award, which is the charity legacy to Princess Diana's belief that young people have the power to change the world. So I have to ask, what do you think is the biggest difference between the generation of young people we're seeing now and those that have come before them?
Yeah, really good question. I think they've probably been through a bit of a sort of brand, rebranding, in the sense that I can remember when I was growing up, and one of the reasons why I got into some of this work, there was this terrible stat from the Prince's Trust that said only 9% of adults felt that young people contribute positively to society, and one in four adults would cross the road if they saw another young person just to avoid them. And I think switch now, I think that was sort of 2009. I think it's changed a lot now, and most young people are volunteering more than adults. There was a study that I think 16, 25 were more likely to volunteer than over 55-year-olds for a charity. So, you know, they're definitely contributing to society. And I think people really believe in that power of the voice of young people now, whereas maybe when you and I were at school, we were allowed to be seen but not maybe heard, and we didn't have much of a student voice. Now, young people's voices are really, really important in conversations around the table. Not quite enough. And I think during the pandemic, they were definitely missing. Young people were affected because of their education, because of their opportunity and freedoms. And you didn't really see them represented in the same way as adults. But I think, yeah, definitely they've been through this whole rebrand, and society looks very different to young people now, which is a really positive aspect.
Really positive. And I think I see that now at Social Chain when we're hiring young people from what they want from their employer. It's not just about the job anymore. It's also about what good can they do within society, and what is that company doing to make the world a better place as well, which I think is part of, because of that, it's what they want to see out of the places that they work, which is only a good thing, isn't it?
Definitely, yeah.
So what do you think that, because of all that, what do you think their legacy is going to be?
Yeah, I think hopefully the from the environment, you know, we'll be living in a maybe a cleaner environment. I think it would be a safer world. If you think about some of the campaigns that young people are leading on making streets safer, making spaces safer for women and girls, and maybe more inclusive as well. To your point around young people really pushing that, I think the greatest challenge that we get at the Diana Award are from our younger members of staff, who rightly so, you know, see the world very differently from perhaps previous or their parents, and are really pushing us to do more. And I think that you're seeing that not only in workplaces but also in schools. So I think it would be probably a cleaner, safer and more inclusive world as a result of this generation.
You've touched on something there about schools, and I get a little bit of my bee in my bonnet about education, and I only really learned my own values when I started recording this podcast, and since knowing them, I've realized the importance of having strong values, and I wish I'd known them earlier. You've stood in your values of empathy and compassion from such a young age. how do we help young people know those better earlier? And is there an issue within the education system that should be looked at to help? Is it something that should be taught in schools?
Yeah, I think absolutely. If I'd learnt more about my values and what I stand for, I think I would have been better off in terms of my mental health, in terms of my choices about who I want to mix with, where I want to study or work. But you're right, it's missing from that education point. And I think there are a lot of things missing in the curriculum, but that is definitely one of the things that's missing. You do see some schools really big on the values, and they not only display them when you enter the school, but they talk about them, talk about what it means, and they bring it to life. But yeah, I think it is a bit of a missing point. I would like to see a lot more lesson-based exploring of the values, but I'm also quite excited about the role of technology. But it's only probably going to happen when the internet and wireless gets a bit better in schools, which we know isn't the best. But I do like this idea of maybe virtual reality and headsets helping you, maybe even exposing you to your values and helping you understand the world around you. Because there's a scary fact that when you're at school, you actually, well, we spent 11,000 hours of our life at school. So a huge amount of time, but we weren't able to really explore who we are or what is the meaning in the world and what is our purpose. So I do like this idea of actually teachers have a pretty hard jobs, but if you were able to maybe put on a headset and explore who you are, who else is in the world, it would just open up that world, which can seem really, really small at school. And you do have to pack a lot into the curriculum. But yeah, I think it's definitely a gap.
And how do you think you knowing your values has helped you with where you are now?
I think it's helped me decide what I want to do. It's given me this real passion and purpose. It's also helped me think about how I want to treat people. And it's helped me, I think, navigate social media as well. So I've been able to always think about empathy, clicking with compassion, when I share or when I like something and think about that person behind the screen, despite that, or the content, or the person the person that the content is about. I think despite that degree of separation, so I think it's absolutely helped me in that sense, and it's also helped me think about how maybe attached I am to social media and maybe less concerned about it because I know my values and because I know who I am and who I stand for.
That's exactly how I feel about it. It's just been tricky. I've done a few talks to teenage girls to help them understand if they know their values, they can not only make better choices in their life, in their real young adult life, but also on their social media as well. Because I don't think anyone really talks about the fact that because social media platforms are algorithm based, if you look at stuff that makes you sad, doesn't know that it's making you sad. It just fuels you more of what you're seeing because they want you on. The whole purpose is to keep you on there and not go into a competitor platform, right? So if you're looking at something that's making you sad, but you're looking at it for a consistent amount of time, you're going to get fed more of that, which is going to fuel that comparison and that sort of negativity. But I want to move on to social media because I think we're quite similar in the way that we view it, in that it has so much negative press, but it's not a negative space. It can be, but there's a lot of positives out of it. And I'd love to hear your opinion on it.
Yeah, no, I think we are really similar on that. And I think particularly for the majority of adults and young people, I think they do have a really safe and happy time on social media. And if you think one of the reasons why we keep coming back to it is it's because of that. It's because of what we find out about communities, because of what we find out about ourselves, that draws us back. But unfortunately, I think those negative experiences, those stories, they do stand out. But I'm always reminded, particularly when we sort of talk about sort of children, that the biggest type of bullying that the biggest type of bullying that children face is in school. So it's verbal. It's just under half of all young people experience bullying at some point. And I'm also talking about definition that it's repetitive. Mm. It's more than once. It's not, you know, it's not someone being unkind, which we have to be resilient about. Mm. But when it comes to cyberbullying, it's more like 6 to 25% of young people have been affected by it. And when they have been cyberbullied for young people, it's usually an extension of what happened in school. So maybe it was drama in school that became digital drama. And I think too often, particularly politicians, are they quick to just say, you know, we need the companies to do something, sort it out, but they need to look a little bit closer and think, well, what's going on in our schools and what are they perhaps not funding around mental health? Because to your point earlier around social media not making you feel better about yourself sometime, and then that content, you're finding more of it. If you're already not feeling very good about yourselves, and you know, maybe because you haven't had those lessons around your values, or you don't understand what makes you happy,
or you're just on a down day,
Yeah. Then going to social media probably just, we know, isn't going to help you. And actually, the some of the chief medical officers, when they looked into this, like found that you're not going to be better off if you're already not feeling that good about yourselves, and then you go on social media. And I think too often we don't look at what else is going on and think, actually, is that the root problem, or is it issues in society? Is it also about, for a child, their sleep, their diet, their friendships, their education? You know, I think there's a lot of other things, but we don't, as so the politicians and the media don't always scratch the surface, and it's quite easy to just blame social media, I think.
Point the finger. Mm. I heard a really good quote from another podcast guest, actually, Dr. T, who's a psychologist, and he said that adults need to be more like tour guides when it comes to social rather than travel agents, because a travel agent doesn't know the terrain. It just tells you to go there, but doesn't have the full information, whereas they need to know which machete to use in which part of the jungle and how to navigate the landscape. Yeah. And as soon as he said that, I was like, that is genius. And I've taken that and I've used it in my own talks. Mm. I've stolen that with pride, because I think it's so important that there's so much blame on one area, but actually you're right. The reality is that it spills out into everything else.
Yeah, it does.
And you're doing quite a lot of work, aren't you? You do a lot of work with the government as well as with the advisory board for some of the platforms. Do you want to tell us a little bit about your role in those?
Yeah. So it actually came from the sort of days when Facebook was fairly new, and always makes me laugh because my mum would get confused between MySpace and Facebook, and she still calls Facebook My Face. So my friend said you posted something on My Face, and I'm like, Mom, that was MySpace for Facebook now. But
it's going to be something completely different now. Yeah, it's going to blow her mind.
Exactly, yeah. That's Meta something. Yeah, Meta Face. But actually, I saw that cyberbullying was a bit of an issue in my sort of area where I grew up, Milton Keynes, and I did a bit of research, and then presented the results, and then just wrote to Facebook, and then got this reply back, which was just great, and ended up in these tiny offices in Covent Garden with someone called Lord Richard Allen, who was the vice president for policy for UMEA Eastern Africa. And that's kind of how we started working together. And then I would bring young people into their offices to sort of talk to them about some of the challenges, some of the benefits. And now Facebook and Instagram actually fund the anti-bullying ambassador program that we run in schools for any secondary school Amazing. That wants it. Not many people know that. And
no, they don't talk about those things.
I think it's a hard story for them to tell, but you're right, they also don't. They're not that good at marketing safety or...
I think it kind of, though, is because they don't want to admit there's a problem. So if they talk about it publicly, it's like they're saying that there is a problem with their platform, which is something that I've come across with them before.
Yeah, interesting, yeah. But yeah, just over the years, just sort of... just try to bring young people into their offices. And now, on the advisory board for Twitch, for TikTok, for Instagram, Facebook, Yubo, a few others. So it's a really interesting experience, like seeing what is possible and perhaps what isn't possible. And more recently, some of those advisory boards, like Twitch, for example, now house creators, so sort of influencers and safety experts. And there is a bit of a clash between... what safety experts sort of, you know, and NGO professionals sort of understand about the issues, and then maybe the desires of creators and influencers, users of the platform. And it's been an interesting tension, but I think it's been definitely positive as a result. But they do consult with quite a lot of NGOs and safety experts across the world.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because we've been looking at something for Social Chain for a good couple of years now about how we can use the knowledge of what we do on social to create either an add-on or a piece of tech or even an app that can help. We've not decided what it is because there's so many variables with it, to help create a better, safer environment for people on social. What are the platforms doing? Because when I've looked at it recently for this project, you only go and find out their opinions and their stance on bullying on, you've got to go off platform, you've got to go online, you've got to go to the T's and C's, and it's all very detailed and it'll take you a long time to read it. What is actually going on there behind? Make it easier for me. What's going on there?
Well, I definitely hear your frustration, and I would say that is actually something, the biggest thing I complain to them about, that you know, they're very good at innovating the product and they can bring out new video features and new sort of, you know, photo features and change the feed and all that sort of stuff, but they're not so good at bringing to the forefront those sort of safety and those rules, and I think they can innovate the product but they can't seem to market the innovation that's going around in safety. So I think that there is a lot of work. You'll see that they were all recently in Parliament and they were criticised about how much they're spending on safety. And I don't think there'll ever be a kind of ideal amount to spend on safety when some of these platforms are serving populations bigger than countries. So it's a big challenge there. But there are a lot of tools. A lot of them fall, I think, on the user. But things like being able to hide certain comments, block certain emojis, being able to use some of those settings, I think those are the very basic. But I think where it gets more difficult is, and I hear this all the time, the sort of call for approaches to complex issues like racism, because I think language and when it comes to race and culture and issues like that are very difficult just to have a blanket approach to. I could be using a racist term to raise awareness of that experience on the platform. So therefore, if they were automatically to apply a label or some sort of filter, that wouldn't necessarily work. They are doing things like, you know, if racist language is used, then it might be automatically detected by machine learning to be reviewed. But I think it's not as simple as saying, you know, that there should just be an approach to language, because language is very complex. It's used by very different, differently by very different groups, and some might be using it in a sort of non, you know, offensive way or an informative way. So I think it's more complex than that. And I think actually we sometimes give too much credit to things like machine learning and artificial intelligence because it's just not there to do it at scale. And then we fall down to the fact that we're waiting on moderators. We need, you know, the community to report. But I think the sad thing is, like, when you think about, say, a company with like a billion users, which is TikTok, even if they applied the rules, you know, policies, enforced them accurately, 99% of the time, that would... and everyone was posting every day one piece of content, those billion people, that would still leave 10 million pieces that slip through the net. And that's the scale of it, right? But it's not to say that that stat of 10 million isn't actually a really important stat, because behind that figure is someone who may have been threatened, may have been harmed in some way or served misinformation. But I think that is the scale of the issue when things like machine learning and artificial intelligence just don't cut it quite yet. Like, you're still relying on the community to report, and then you're relying on moderators who have a good understanding of context and are trying to distinguish between someone just joking, you know, with a friend or someone actually causing serious harm. So
it's so complex, isn't it? And that was one of the things when we were doing our research into online bullying, because there's no actual legal definition, is there, of bullying in the UK. So what we found is that people can't differentiate sometimes between someone having a laugh, if you're on the periphery of it and you're complicit in it because you're involved, someone having a laugh with someone on banter versus what could actually be seen as bullying, and the definition isn't there. So it makes it even harder then for the platforms to be able to stop bullying, because what is the definition of bullying? Yeah. And then when she starts to look at that, you're like, oh God, it is really difficult. And also because they're under different government guidelines, aren't they? So we'll have different laws to what another country is, and they cross so many different borders that it makes things really hard. You talked a bit there about race. I want to pick up on something that happened in the summer that it's been highlighted even more, and something that we did briefly discuss before we started recording was the Euros. And the response to us not winning the final and the reaction that created, especially on Twitter. Mm. How was that, and what has happened post that? Like, what have you noticed through your work?
Yeah, and you know, that was really, really distressing to see. I think now the dust has sort of settled a bit. Like, we certainly being an advisor on some of these companies where there was a lot of that content hosted, we know a little bit more about what happened. And the thing that surprises me actually is that most of the abuse actually came from the UK, UK accounts. So that suggests to me that we've still got a long way to go to tackling racism, with people from this country who decided to act that way. But also I was really inspired in a way, because social media kind of lit up with this excitement around maybe verifying people's ID is the way forward to stopping this. And I loved the enthusiasm, but I did think it was quite flawed actually, because for example, on Twitter, like 99% of all the accounts that were involved in racist abuse were actually from people that were not anonymous. So that's probably not gonna solve it. But also it presented some real problems around not everyone has the same access to ID as others. And when I was growing up and I was on free school meals and I didn't go abroad for holidays, so I didn't have a passport actually. And not till I was like maybe 21 or something. So I wouldn't have been able to necessarily, if there was a blanket ban, you can't use social media without verifying your ID. That would have been difficult for me. And we know in other countries, women don't have access to ID so freely. And then maybe if you are from a minority or you have protected characteristics, perhaps you're from the LGBTQ plus community, or you perhaps don't want to reveal who you are, then that freedom is stopped. So I loved the enthusiasm around the ID sort of crusade, but I didn't feel like that was gonna fix it. And then there were some mistakes actually that were made around the moderation, so things weren't flagged properly. But I think maybe, and the company should know better, but you would like to think that like maybe emojis wouldn't have been used in that way. And like, there's a lot now that they've flagged and they've categorized that maybe could be indicated. But what's the solution? Do you look for a user who's using excessively that emoji? But is that just me and you having a laugh? Like, so do you look at the frequency? What are you automatically trying to catch? And then how do you balance that right to sort of freedom and privacy? Because I remember Twitter did this great initiative once where they teamed up with the Samaritans and they were scanning for tweets that maybe indicated a user was depressed not in a great place. But then that came back to sort of bite them, because a lot of users, I think machine learning wasn't capturing right. It didn't understand humor or banter or context.
Yeah.
So it wasn't serving up the sort of right responses to people. So it's quite hard to catch everything. But I think there has been some progress now around things like even just now being able to block certain emojis and words in your DMs on Instagram. Yeah, that came as a result of this. But I still don't know what the answer is.
No, I don't either. It's tricky. And I was with you on the ID. I don't think I didn't come out and say that the IDs were necessarily a good idea. I think that social, in its good, creates a community space for people to be who they want to be, not necessarily who they identify as in the outside world. My brother is non-binary.
Yeah.
He came out to me about 18 months ago, and I know what he's managed to build on social is a world where he feels supported and gets that information. I think for me, though, in the aftermath of the Euros, what frustrated me was that I could write something about COVID on Instagram and put it on a story and I'd get a notification about NHS and making sure you've been vaccinated. But there didn't seem to be anything at all from Instagram apart from the user can notify if you feel like this is a comment that you don't want to get.
Mm.
But then it's that boundary thing. Yeah, it's like, how do I know if that's banter? Or I might interpret that as something different to what someone else might.
And also, that where does that list end in terms of topics that therefore you'd have to present some information on? And
that's true.
And yeah, I think that's the difficult thing. Mm. I think for me, like, where would that end? And I think with something like health and pandemic, it's global. It's kind of pretty cut through. You know, you can provide facts on it. But I think, and I'm obviously not Instagram. I don't represent anything.
Yeah, no.
But I think I think their answers with it. If I was to put the hat on, I think they would say, and they are trying something. And it's rolling out markets, but they're trying something called nudges, and then on Twitter they're doing something called like, "Would you, do you really want to post this?" And it's experimenting around if certain words, or topics are used, then it might prompt the user to do that.
Yeah.
I feel like that COVID label, and then doing the equivalent with racism, like what would you present to user, and then like there'd be a long queue of interested parties who said, "I need this, you know, this topic now being, you know, highlighted because it's important to me," and so that's difficult. Yeah,
it is tricky, but I think the technology is there to identify it.
Yeah, you're right.
And
there,
that's the thing.
Yeah, yeah,
that's the thing that they can use, and it's great that they're looking at those nudges, because if they're identifying it before someone posts, it can stop it even going out in the world. Yeah. Fingers crossed.
Yeah, fingers crossed.
I mean, I'm really lucky. Like, my community is great, and I get very little negativity, so I've done really well out of it. But it is such a big thing. Before this podcast, we asked you to come armed with an admission submission of your own, and the podcast is called "I Shouldn't Say This But," because in every episode I try and open up with honesty and talk about subjects that perhaps someone in my role as a managing director would usually avoid. So I've talked about things like anxiety, imposter syndrome and fear of failure. So would you mind sharing your admission submission of something that you probably shouldn't say, whether that's struggles about your something you faced in your career, a secret about lockdown, or something you're trying to overcome? So, Alex, I shouldn't say this, but...
Yeah, I shouldn't say this, but I hate cancel culture.
Oh,
I hate it with a passion.
Such a good one!
Absolutely hate it.
Why?
Because, well, firstly, maybe as an employer, I quite like people who aren't perfect and who have lived experience and who see things differently, but also as a human, I think we're all constantly making mistakes, and I think I also just hate the idea of a particularly a young person making one mistake because they believed that thing at the time, or they tweeted or posted that thing at the time, and then that stops them from, you know, achieving what they want because it was found. And you see it a lot with people, maybe sort of rappers who are on the rise, and then, you know, something they said at age 15 is now plastered by the media, and I think it lacks compassion, and, you know, lacks empathy, but people are very different from the, you know, the person that they were maybe two years ago, or, you know, last year. And actually that's progress, when somebody has reflected on what they did or who they were, and they think differently. And maybe also I'm quite passionate about it because through this work I've become mega friends with Monica Lewinsky, who, you know, everyone
in like experience on cancel culture.
Yeah, I think you're right. Monica is absolute, you know, the kind of patient zero of cancel culture, and has found it very hard to move on from that one incident when she was an intern, age 20, 21. There was an imbalance of power with, you know, the president there. And then she saw her name in, you know, 100 rap songs. Like, she, it's interesting we're talking about what is taught on the curriculum. In America, you're taught about that, but you're not allowed to, you know, you're not taught about the imbalance or the actual detail there. But yeah, I think everyone deserves a past, and it's important that, you know, a bit like how we were talking about a definition of bullying, it's got to be repetitive. It's not about, you know, one off. So therefore, in the same sort of vein, like, we want people to reflect and to not make the same mistakes. So therefore, I think cancel culture is just not really healthy. Mm. It doesn't allow people to make their mistakes. And what we often hear is, like, we hear about all the problems in the world and the problems with people and people's behavior, but then, you know, there's got to be that sort of acceptance that people are going to get it wrong then, and let's help them and move them on. Otherwise, they become stuck. You know, imagine being cancelled for something and you think, well, I was, you know, that was me then, but I've changed now, and then you're being put back in the box, and maybe, you know, you're stuck, you can't move on, you think about displaying that behaviour again. So yeah, it really frustrates me.
It's a therapist's dream though, isn't it, that? Because if you cancel, and it's so true, cancel culture then stops you from doing the same thing again, but you might have learned from it, but you might not want to speak up on another topic out of fear of being caught again, which then makes you not feel like your voice is important, which then could really impact you in the future in how you make decisions. And I'd never really thought of that before. And everyone needs to make mistakes. You need to learn from them, don't you? And if you're constantly told that you're... It's a really, really interesting point of view. What advice do you think you can give to people who feel as though they have been a part of cancel culture?
Yeah, advice... Because, I mean, the other story that sticks in my mind is this kid from Scotland who, you know, actually was sort of duped into sharing some images of himself and actually ended up seriously hurting himself because of that one experience, because his community, his school sort of cancelled it because of that. And you think, it does make me really think then that actually cancel culture does kill. Mm. And, you know, there was another terrible case where this woman was tracked down who was a troll, you know, an online troll, and was really nasty. And I think it was a Sky News journalist, like, door knocked her, and she killed us, you know, herself after being sort of exposed. So, I mean, that is a very extreme, and, you know, very rare as well. But I think it does. It's not healthy. I don't think it helps people. But I always like to say, if you ever have a sort of problem or worry or concern, like, remembering that there are people that you can turn to your point, you'll find a tribe, you know, on the internet, you'll find people that maybe have shared that same experience. And I think the internet is, like, such a great resource for young people in that sense. But I would say to people, like, you still have something really valuable to offer. And as an employer, you know, I would want to talk to you. I'd want to hear you. And I think you can have something really valuable to contribute. So, and it also reminds me of, it's not the greatest example, maybe what I think going on, but actually one of the Facebook executives kind of, you know, said to me, like, I'd much rather hire, you know, someone that does have, you know, a bit of a interesting past, like, and I thought that when I was 10 years ago, that, you know, hearing that sort of acceptance, I think is really important. And like, we all make mistakes, I don't know who we are. So I think it's important that we don't silence people and we don't, you know, treat them differently just because of one mistake. Now, yeah, if you constantly repeat that mistake, that might be a problem. And even Monica Lewinsky always reminds, you know, everyone that, like, that was one mistake. She didn't go on to have more affairs with presidents. Like, then maybe she should say, you know, you could have treated me differently if that was the case. But I think we've got to be a little bit more compassionate there.
Yeah, and care about people. And that goes back to the very beginning of what we discussed, of knowing your values, because if you know your values and you know yourself, then you're less likely to cancel other people, because you should have that compassion for other people and know that everyone's different. Absolutely, like, incredible to talk to you. We could probably talk for hours.
Yeah,
but
very good.
But I know you've got other places to be. Is there anything that you want to guide the listeners to for any sort of advice that they need to go and find? Anything that you want to leave the listeners with before?
I love that. I think like, maybe a bit of practical stuff. Like, I think look at the apps that you're using and look at the settings. Like, there are some really good tools and some privacy settings that a lot of them are hidden, which isn't helpful. And it's part of the thing that I'm moaning at all the companies to do a better job at surfacing, but you can create your experience and you can think about restricting, muting, blocking keywords. So I think have a look at the apps that you're on and kind of think, and also who you're connected to, like do those people make you happy? If not, maybe remove them.
Or mute them, because then they don't know that, yeah,
they don't know,
yeah,
exactly.
They don't know.
Yeah,
that.
Yeah. And I think, yeah, the other thing is, like, if you know a school, you know, we're on a bit of a mission. Like, I got bullied at school, and that's why I started the Anti-Bullying Ambassador Program, and we've reached around 4,000 schools, trained 35,000 young people, but this program is free. Some of it is supported by social media companies. Mm-hmm. So I think, yeah, find out a little bit about the Diana Award Anti-Bullying Ambassador Program. Tell a school about it, because we spend 11,000 hours of our life there. And if you could create a team of ambassadors, then you might be just like making at least one child's life a little bit better. Certainly the kind of 10, 11-year-old Alex, I think, would have had a better experience if I'd had an anti-bullying ambassador, someone I could talk to or go to, and someone that'd stand up for me. So, yeah, introduce a school, you know, or a teacher to the Anti-Bullying Ambassador Program.
Amazing. Oh, thank you so much, Alex. It's just been an absolute pleasure. Absolute gold of an episode. And, yeah, it makes me feel very proud that I've got this platform to be able to share your message. So thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks. And, yeah, thanks. I know you've talked about these issues quite a lot on your podcast. So thanks for constantly shining a light. I think these are important conversations that we all need to be having.
It's been absolutely fantastic to speak to Alex today. The work he is doing is incredible, and I'm so grateful for him taking time out to come onto the podcast. I really hope that you found this episode enjoyable as much as I did recording it, but also you got some real value out of it. So thank you for listening. Like and subscribe as always, and I'll be back with another episode of I Shouldn't Say This But next week.